on April 2nd, I turned 60 years old. And I got to tell you, that is a strange thing to wrap your head around. I mean, all the decade ones are. You know, 30 was weird, 40, 50, but 60? 60 is a big one. And I was feeling a little bit blue about it for a half a second. And my wife said, look, you know, if you don't get to be, if you don't live long enough to be 60, you don't get to be a grandfather the way you are. And I thought, you know, I really do like being a grandfather. Now, don't be worried. I'm not going to go into it in big way, but I will tell you that today I got this little video sent to me from my little granddaughter, my four-year-old granddaughter's preschool, that shows her leading a song. All the kids are sitting in front of her and they take turns doing this, being the song leader. And I saw her and I thought, oh my gosh, it's happening. Another upfront Campolo public speaker. It's you know, so I uploaded it. If you're interested, I uploaded it on the Patreon page, which is not coincidentally where you would go. I mean, a lot of you are Patreon people already. You support the podcast, so you can go find it there. If you're not, and you want to see that, you want to see the video, support the podcast. You can do it for a buck a month. It's not a big deal to you, but it's a huge deal to us, because the more people that support the podcast, the more we get to do cool stuff. And so, yeah, I'm 60. I got grandchildren. I'm old. And yet, do you sense the excitement and the energy in my voice? Do you sense that I still have it? Because that's what I'm trying to communicate, that I still have it. The joy de vivre, the human spirit, the gratitude for this privilege, this fleeting privilege, this very quickly fleeting privilege of consciousness. And in that spirit, in that spirit of joy de vivre, I'm very excited to share with you one of the most fun people that I've ever introduced you to on this podcast, Todd May. I want to start out by saying he's a fun person, because that will not cover the fact that he is a brilliant person. Todd is a brilliant philosopher. He has written 16 books of philosophy. These are not self-published books. These are books published by the University of Chicago Press, which, if you're into all that academic stuff, is like very, very prestigious. Todd's been a professor of philosophy at Clemson University for like 20 some years. I mean, he's been there for a long time, and he's written all sorts of stuff. But his last three books are really interesting. The titles of his last three books are A Significant Life, A Fragile Life, and A Decent Life. It was when we saw A Decent Life that I thought, oh, we've got to have this guy. Now, you may have seen Todd, because Todd got interviewed on the subject of death in the New York Times a few years ago in a hugely influential and popular article. But Todd's most high profile work, you probably don't know about that he did it, because he was the philosophy consultant on the TV series The Good Life. And we talk about that in the conversation. I think you'll find it really interesting. But so many people came up to me and said, have you seen The Good Life? Oh, it's so profound and says all these things about life and death and meaning and truth. And you're thinking like, yeah, how do these Hollywood writers figure out all that stuff? And it turns out they have a philosophy guy behind them whispering in their ear. And I'm glad he's the one whispering, because this last book, A Decent Life, the subtitle is great: Morality for the Rest of Us. And what Todd kind of points out is, he says, most of the books about ethics, whether they're religious or secular, they're all about trying to be altruistic, about trying to like be this kind of saintly person, a moral saint who does all the right things in all the situations. And Todd says, you know, the truth is that most of us, while we don't want to be moral monsters, we also don't really aspire to be moral saints. What we want to be is decent human beings. He says, you know, probably that's what we should be writing philosophy books about how to be decent. And he really lays out in very kind of comprehensible but still high-minded way what it means to be decent. And I just, like, for me, it's a more realistic approach to making the most of your life. Because the truth of the matter is that, you know, if you try to be morally perfect, you'll end up having no time for anything else. You won't be able to buy a shirt because you'd be so worried about the sourcing of the thread and the this and that. And you go, yeah, but shouldn't we care about like sweatshops in Africa? And you go, yeah, there are definitely shirts you shouldn't buy. But if you go to the nth degree, you'll go crazy. And Todd May is here to help us all not go crazy, but become more the kind of human beings that we want to be. This is such a humanize me guy. And I'm really excited for you to listen in on this conversation. I love talking to him. I think you'll love hearing him. So this is me and Todd May chopping it up on Humanize Me. Todd, thank you so much for doing this.
No, Bart, it's my pleasure. Sometimes it's called a journey, and that can be a bit of a stereotype. But in your case, it was really a journey. It was a journey like off a bike, right?
Yeah.
And then a personal journey. And so it was really fascinating to read about you, and I'm just thrilled to be here.
Yeah. And likewise with me, it's so funny because usually when I talk to people that are academics or that have academic backgrounds, like the first thing that you find out about them is where they teach. And I had to dig, what the first thing I found out about you is like that you've written 16 books.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is that on purpose? Like, do you think of yourself more as a philosopher and a writer than you do as a professor?
Well, let me put it this way, Bart. I spent 31 years in Clemson, South Carolina, before I was, shall we say, paroled.
I was going to say liberated, but I didn't want to say it because I've been to Clemson.
Okay, so you know. And given all that there is to do at Clemson, right, writing is a real option. and so, yeah, I had time. I am curious, and I do think as I write. That helps me think. Yeah. Gather my thoughts. You've written, you know what it's like. You have a vague sense of what your thoughts are. You think you know, and then you start to write and you start realizing this stuff that you thought you knew you didn't know quite so well. So you have to think about it more. And that's where the writing came in.
Yeah, it's so interesting, Todd, because I have written just enough to know that I'm not a writer because I'm so painstakingly slow. Like I can't move on to one sentence unless I've perfected the sentence before it. And so it slows me down so much that I can't think that way anymore. This podcast is much more in keeping with how my thinking works, is that I actually think by talking.
That's interesting. I can see that, right? Yeah. I can see that people do that. Sometimes that'll happen to me while I'm teaching, but I don't have the perfectionism that you have. And I think that's partly because I know that there's a lot of philosophers out there that are smarter than I am. So I figured, okay, I'll point in a direction and maybe this is something that somebody who's really better than I am can pick up and run with. But I'm not going to worry if it's not exactly right.
Yeah, there is a certain humility in the way that you write. And in particular, I'm thinking about this latest book. There seems to be a certain humility there in saying, listen, I'm not going to be like I'm not, it's funny. It feels like a guy on a date, like I'm not like all those other philosophers. but I feel like what you're proposing is that this perfectionism, not just in the writing itself, but in the goal of the philosophy is a problem.
Yes, I want to be real careful here with the Bart. I think that's right for most of us. I don't want to say that nobody should seek for the kind of perfection that some of the moral theories propose. It might well be that that's a space that they want to occupy. But I don't think most of us do want to occupy that space. And I'm not sure that the world would be that much better a place or even a better place if all of us occupied that space. So the question then is, okay, if we're not going to occupy the good life as it's defined differently by the different philosophers, how can we think about our moral lives in ways that capture the lives themselves, but that also can open up a space to move forward a little bit if that's where we want to go?
It's funny because as somebody who did exit a moral system, you know, because evangelical Christianity, if nothing else, is a kind of a moral system that definitely places altruism and kind of perfect altruism as embodied in Jesus as the goal. And almost on purpose, it's an unattainable goal. There's a recognition that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. And that's why you need to join the religion, because you need forgiveness, you need grace, because you yourself are morally unworthy. But even after you buy into the grace, then they're like, yeah, but get back to trying to be morally perfect, even though you'll always fail. But as somebody who comes out of that, when I came out of that, there was a certain amount of relief, but there's also a certain amount of confusion or lostness. You go like, okay, so what are we going for now? And I think that when I turned back to my philosophy books, because, you know, all the time I was coming up in college, you know, philosophy was for the secular people. Mm-hmm. We studied theology.
Yeah.
Doggone it. But when I turned back to philosophy, I did find exactly what you are talking about. I found that most of the big systems, they were, the standard was every bit as high as Almighty God had for me. Peter Singer is no less exacting than Jesus.
Oh, yeah. No, that's right. That's right. But let me say one thing as a side note about your study and then come back, Mark, because I think you're right. Philosophy has focused on the secular to the point where I think it can be really dismissive of people who have theological commitments. And that's unfortunate. I did an interview for the Times on Death with a philosopher who'd been interviewing various religious people and then wanted to interview an atheist. And one of the first things that I wanted to make sure everybody I was clear about was that there are a lot of very religious people doing work that I admire and that's beyond what I could even do. People who are working to bring food and water to immigrants in the desert, people who aren't documented into their homes and things like that. So I think there is a sort of bias against religion and much philosophy that I think is unfortunate. But let me turn also to the ideas themselves and take what you said about not measuring up and needing forgiveness and see if we can't, Bart, flip the script. So instead of seeing us always as lacking and unworthy and needing to move on, why don't we see us as all seeking to be decent people and maybe seeing if we can introduce, as the term I used in the book, a little more moral gracefulness into our lives. So it's not that we're lacking and we need to make up, but rather most of us are decent and we might be able to add to that decency in ways that are not a burden, but that open up a way of not grace in terms of the grace that we get from God, but if I can put it the image this way, a moral gracefulness in how we move through the world, like a dancer.
Like a dancer, I was going to say, yeah. Yeah, you're not talking about graciousness. You're talking about gracefulness. Like,
yes.
Isn't this a more beautiful way to live?
Yeah.
I mean, before we go too far, I want to frame the book. I want to sort of go like, okay. So I open up this book. The first thing that strikes me is that its title is Decency, which, you know, decency is a middling term. That's decent. And so I'm aware that you're, I don't want to say aiming low, but aiming reasonable. So when you sat down to write this book, I mean, after writing 15 other books of philosophy, what is the problem that you're trying to address? Like when you said, I need to write this book, what are you trying to say?
Good. So Bart, here's the genesis of the book. It doesn't come from me. I had written a number of books and had a great editor at Chicago Press. And I emailed her at one point and I said, you know, I'm out of ideas. I don't know what else I should be writing here. And she said, let me think about this. And then she said, can I call you on the phone? So we spoke and she said, do you know Peter Singer's work? And I said, yeah. She says, do you know his book, The Most Good You Can Do? I said, yeah, it's about, you know, people who like take jobs on Wall Street so that they can give away all their money and they give away one of their kidneys and things like that. I said, yeah, I know that book. I know his work and I know that book. And as you said, Bart, it's just as rigorous as any religious philosopher. So I said, yeah, so now what? She says, here's what I want you to do, Todd. I want you to write The Most Good You Could Do for sane people. And immediately, Bart, I knew what she was talking about, right? And I, within a week, I had an outline, right? Part of it is because the core idea came from a previous book I'd written on nonviolence. And the idea of nonviolence is just trying to respect that the people you're aligned with, as well as your adversaries, are people that have basic human desires. They want food, they want shelter, they don't want to feel alone, they want to feel their life has some sort of meaning. And so the question that I was trying to answer in the book was, okay, how do we frame that philosophically, which doesn't lead us toward having to maximize how good we are, but does lead us toward respecting the dignity of people around us?
That idea that the people on the other side of an issue, of a subway car, of any dispute in your life, I think that's one thing to say, like, yeah, I know they have lives to live. I know they have desires and things like that. What I remember about Peter Singer, and you highlighted this too, when you were describing Peter Singer, is that he was like, those people not only have lives to live, they have moral value. And in fact, he seems to suggest that they have every bit as much moral value as you do.
Yeah.
They are equally, there's some sense of like the interests of all human beings are equal. Do you buy that?
In some sense, Bart, yes. And in some sense, I think it can lead us astray. Okay. The idea that everyone has equal moral value can mean that, look, we all have lives to live, and to the extent to which we can respect that in one another, we should. Sometimes we can't. The classic case is a case of self-defense. I can't respect the other if they're attacking me. But here's where things tend to go astray. Does this mean that I'm supposed to treat everyone equally as having equal demands on me? Am I supposed to treat your kids as having the same moral demands on me as my kids, right? How am I supposed to think about that? So we can say, on the one hand, that everybody has equal moral worth, but that doesn't mean, Bart, at least it doesn't mean to me, that we have the same moral demands relative to everyone else.
I guess to me, even the former premise, I mean, obviously the latter, like, no, you're not going to treat your kids as though they're as important as mine. And in a weird way, I don't want you to, because if you do, I would question you. I would not trust you as a human being if you treated your kids as important as my kids, or my kids as important as yours.
Yeah, that would be just weird.
I'd be like, wow, there's something wrong with that guy. Yeah. And what's more is, like, I want you to look after your kids so that I don't have to. I don't have to feel any guilt about looking after mine, because I want to look after mine. And sometimes, like, I feel guilty about that, but then I'm like, oh, you know, Todd's taking care of his kids, I'll take care of mine.
Yeah.
And so what troubles me about this philosophically, and I should never use that word because I know so little of philosophy, but one thing I do know is that I don't believe in objectivity. Like, the idea that there is value is by its very nature a subjective term. Things value to people. Things are valued by people. Things matter to people. And so, like, the idea that there's such a thing as objective value would mean, like, well, who's the one person who all these things matter to? Now, it makes sense in a monotheistic culture. But if you take away God, there's no such thing as objective value. There's only subjective value.
Yeah, this gets into some deep waters.
I'm sorry.
Very quickly.
No, I don't want to go there. I'm scared.
No, you've thought about these things, right? You say you're not a philosopher. To me, that there are professional philosophers, people who get paid for this, but philosophy is what people do when they're thinking reflectively about their lives, right? And you've obviously done this a lot, so why?
And kind of that's where you start. That's where you start your book. Like, literally, the first line I remember reading, the first thing that stuck out to me is, you're like, if you picked up this book, you're a good person. Because you're trying to be a good person, because you're thinking about being a good person. Nobody who doesn't care about being a good person picks up a book about moral decency.
Right. That's right.
Okay. So,
that's right. Right.
So on some level, I guess we are all philosophers in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. Anybody who is turning reflectively on their lives and trying to sort themselves out is doing philosophy.
Okay.
Right? But let me push back against the objective-subjective distinction. You want to say, well, if it's objective, it has to have some objective source that it comes from, that I can give you reasons for certain moral claims, reasons that aren't simply subjective to me, but part of, they say, the culture that we're in, and in many cases, part of a number of cultures. So the wrongness of, say, torture, we'll use as an example, right? I can give you lots of reasons not to torture people, and I would say that's objective in the sense that that's what the reasons support. Those reasons will probably hook onto you, right? Obviously, you can think of lots of reasons not to torture people. It's not simply my view, like, that torturing is wrong in the same way it would be my view that drinking old fashions is better than drinking martinis, right? There are reasons we can give to one another. And those reasons, I think, come as close to objectivity as anybody can. Give me one more step.
Okay, I'm sorry.
In that sense, Bart, it's the same thing that science does. Science claims are objective in the sense that we believe them because of the best evidence supporting them. They can be objective and yet fallible.
Yes. The problem for me is you're talking to somebody who comes out of a religious background. And what happens when you come out of a mainstream religion like I did is that you realize that the fact that a billion people agree on something culturally doesn't mean it's in any way true.
I agree with that.
And so the fact that like an entire culture or multiple cultures would agree that torture is wrong, I go like, that doesn't help me because like those same cultures at one point thought slavery was right.
Yes. And what I want to say is it's not the agreement. It's not the number of people agreeing. It's where the reasons go.
Okay.
There can be reasons out there that people don't recognize, but that are commitments, consequences of things they do realize. So for instance, let's take slavery. Okay. Slavery was once fairly broadly accepted in the U.S. But even at the time it was accepted, there were good reasons to believe, right, that it was evil. Those reasons weren't recognized, but the reasons were there. The reasons were, we could say, consequences, or for use of technical philosophy, or entailments of reasons that people already held. And so it's not that we take votes to find out what's right. It's that we reflect on the reasons that we have and ask what reasons there are to do something and what reasons there are not to do something. Now, Bart, you can keep asking, okay, why is that a good reason? And I give you another one. Why is that a good reason? And I give you another one. And at some point, I've got to stop. I have to say, well, this is just something I'm committed to.
This is an a priori assumption.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
What is yours? What's your bottom line? Turtles all the way down to what?
Well, it's not going to be a single one. There'll be different ones. But one of them, if we can come back to it, right, is that people all have the same moral worth. All are to be respected.
And what's funny is that, because when I came out of faith, the first person that made any sense to me was a minister's daughter named Ursula Goodenough, who wrote a book called The Sacred Depths of Nature, in which she sort of was like, listen, it turns out that the epic of evolution is every bit as sort of magnificent as any religious epic. And the thing you've got to understand is that life is the thing. Life is the thing worthy of our devotion. And so she would say, and what I sort of picked up on was, is that what is the sort of the biological imperative of everything that survives is the desire to push its DNA forward. And therefore that what makes something good or bad is whether or not it promotes your DNA going forward, life, or whether or not it reduces the possibility of that. And so like for me, like the idea that all people are equal or all people have equal value, Like, that's just not biologically true. You know, within any tribe, there are some members that increase the possibility of life going forward for that tribe, or of life going forward, period. And it seems to me that those lives are objectively more important.
Yeah. And here's where I think there's a distinction that needs to be made between what we might call evolutionary success on the one hand,
right,
and moral regard on the other. So let's just say that there's another strain of a COVID-like disease. And that strain is so virulent that it kills everybody. So it's successfully reproduced and killed everybody. We were not successful. The virus was successful. I don't think that that makes the virus better. I just think it makes it more successful.
Right, right. Oh, and so that's why, like, you take care of your kids and I take care of my kids, because I'm not actually equally committed to all life going forward. I'm actually committed to my life and my DNA going forward. And so is the COVID virus, and so are the cockroaches. Like, you and I might be more committed to human life going forward than we are to cockroaches going forward. But then when it comes down to human life versus human life, like, yeah, I'm more committed to Campolo life going forward, and you're more committed to May life going forward.
Oh, right, right.
I'm just like, that's realistic. That's realistic.
I don't disagree with that, but let me push back on one part of that, Bart, because I don't think that you're committed to your DNA going forward. Not you as a person. If all of a sudden your kids, like, develop something that changed their DNA, right? You wouldn't be like, forget it, right? That's new DNA.
You're right. You're right.
So this is important, because what you're actually committed to is not your DNA going forward. It is these people, your kids, right? Their individual lives and existence. That's what you're committed to. That's what you're committed to going forward. And you're committed to it going forward more than you're committed to my kids going forward. By the way, a fact that makes me enormously angry with you. No.
No, and what I would say is, like, the fact that you're right, like, even if my kids were not going to reproduce, if they were sterile, I would still be committed to them.
Sure.
But, like, that's a vestigial, like, that love is hardwired into me. It's instinctual, and it's based on the general principle of, most of the time when you have kids, that's where it comes from. It comes from that chain of life. I'm off on a tangent here, but I guess the thing is that I feel like when I get to Peter Singer's like, listen, if you can save a child in Africa from starving by not taking your kid to the movies, you should do that. And I go, like, and his basis is that kid's equally valuable as your kid. And I sort of go, like, yeah, that's not how it works. We value our own children more highly and our own friends and family more highly for a reason. And that reason is important.
We can still call to the distinction that on the one hand, everybody has equal moral worth, without holding to the idea that each person has an equal moral demand on me. I think that's a distinction we need to hold on to.
Okay.
And so we can say, look, your kids, right, have more of a moral demand on you. And in addition to that, your relationship to your kids is not simply a moral one. Right? There are other values aside from morality. This is something that I talked about in the book that the philosopher Susan Wolf is on about. There are values like love and music and things like that, which may not be moral values, but are part of the human experience. And sometimes it's worth putting a moral value a little bit to the side and not letting it trump everything, otherwise from Peter Singer, and allowing other values, the values of love, the values of music, right, other values to have their place in our lives.
Because in that effective altruism world, everybody eats, everybody has shelter, but there is no Beethoven and there is no Sydney Opera House. And so the very things that we want to stay alive, that make life rich and full when we're alive, aren't there. It's a flat life.
Yeah. And it may in some sense be a morally better world because everybody's eating and people don't have disease. But it lacks a certain richness because there are values that aren't moral values, but nevertheless values worth pursuing. And people can give, if they want, an evolutionary explanation for this, that we find this amusing or that it makes our lives interesting. But But at that point, I think the fact that we can explain that loses its grip on the status of the valuing itself.
So take me back to the book, because like I feel like I stumbled into, like you said, the deep weeds. But take me back to the book in the sense of you're answering your editor's question. And she says, what would this look like? You know, what would it look like to be a good person for sane people? This sounds terrible. Do you have a short answer for that?
Let me explain the frame, because the frame is what the book did. Okay.
Yeah.
So I start by asking, okay, if I'm trying to be decent, what is it to be decent to people immediately around me? My family, strangers I meet on the train, colleagues. What does decency consist of if I just look at my immediate circle? And then I widen it. Okay, what does decency look like with people that are far away in time or far away in space, but generations to come, or people that I'm never going to meet? What does decency look like there? And then I widen it out a little bit more and say, okay, how about non-human animals? What does decency look like there? And then I look structurally, politically, and say, what does political decency look like when we're talking about systems? So I start from what's closest and then try to move out and try to say, okay, here's a way to think about it with people around you, with strangers, with generations to come, with non-human animals, with political structures, and then try to sort that out. But in all cases, what I'm offering, Bart, and this is the, I think, necessary humility, are ways to frame it, suggestions, examples, things that can give a feel rather than saying, here's a formula.
Yeah, it was interesting because you begin the book in the first chapter by outlining like different schools of philosophical thought or different schools of moral thinking. And in each one, you go like, yeah, it's good, but it's got quirks.
Yeah.
And I think there's an understanding that no system can sort of cover all the possibilities.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Maybe if we just run through together the kind of the three existing systems that you sort of are like, these all ask too much of us.
Good, sure. One of the systems is consequentialism. One should act in such a way as to cause the best overall consequences. Very much the Peter Singer view. And the Peter Singer view, there are technical problems with it. For instance, if something would cause more happiness and yet be unjust to a minority, is that okay? Right? For the consequentialists, they might think that's okay. There are the stringency of the requirements, which Bart, you've pointed out to. There are difficulties there. Then there's Kantian deontology. And deontology focuses not on the consequences of the act, but the intention, having the right intention. And for Kant, the right intention was to act in a way that you can imagine everybody in this situation acting like the same way under the same circumstances.
That's what he called, that's the moral imperative, right?
Yeah, called it the categorical imperative.
And
among the things that you can't ever do, right, is you can't lie, because you can't imagine a world in which everybody lied, because lying would lose its point. Nobody would believe anybody. So you, for Kant, you can't ever lie. So, Bart, think about this. This is going to be personal to you and me now. When I started to lose my hair, my spouse said to me, oh, Ty, you're not losing. You're fine. You're not losing your hair. Now, Bart, there are mirrors in my house. I knew what was happening to my hair. And yet what Kant would have said is she acted morally incorrectly, right? She lied. She knew I was losing my hair. So there's a weird stringency with Kant as well.
My wife would have responded to Kant by saying, my wife's response to that was she lied too. She said, you know what? I actually always have preferred bald-headed men. And that's my thing. So this is fine. I think if I had had Fabio-like hair, she would have never said that. But it felt good.
I would say that was thoughtful and transparent.
But I guess Kant also like struggles with the Nazi at the door. Do you have any Jews in your home?
Yeah.
And Kant would say, yeah, you actually have to say yes. You do. You have to tell the truth.
Kant tried to weasel this one. Of course, it wasn't with Nazis because that was after them. But if we use the Nazi example, are there Nazis in your house? Are you hiding Nazis?
No, hiding Jews.
Are you hiding Jews, right?
Nobody should hide Nazis.
Right, that's true. And you can say, well, I did see some Jews down the road. It was like a couple hours ago. And you could sort of weave a story where you're not exactly answering, and yet you're not lying. Now, that was Kant's move. It seemed, even if it was in keeping with the letter of Kant's view, it doesn't seem to keep so much to the spirit of it. But that was the kind of, he tried to weasel this when he was confronted with these
kinds of things. Because then you'd be living in a world, if everybody did that, you'd be living in a world where nobody answered any questions in a way that was helpful. And you couldn't proceed as a society either.
Yeah. There's all kinds of problems with that. Right? But if we turn it to Aristotle, third one. So Aristotle's, his ethics, they're very different from consequentialist. Because the question that Kant asked and the question that consequentialist asked is, how do I act in this situation? What is the right thing to do in this situation?
Right.
Aristotle looked at it very differently. His view was not looking situation by situation, but asking, what kind of person should you be? When Aristotle asked that question, he has a whole cosmological background behind him, right? But he thinks everything in the universe has its telos, its goal, the thing it's supposed to be. And the question is, okay, what are human beings supposed to be? And he talks about human beings are supposed to be, he uses the word eudaimonia, which is usually translated as happiness. I don't like the translation happiness because it has weird connotations for us. I prefer when people translate it as flourishing.
You know, it's funny. I study psychology, and like Martin Seligman, the positive psychologist, he wrote a book about happiness, and he ended up having to rewrite the book and call it flourishing because he was like, happiness sounded too shallow. It had all these bad connotations. And so he defined flourishing as the actual goal. And so I guess the same thing.
And so that flourishing is developing of various virtues, developing friendship and loyalty and courage and temperance. And he thought that the flourishing person developed all of these, and they've dealt all of these to the max. So now we have two potential problems, right? One problem is that it's unclear in Aristotle's case how much concern for the other as other matters. For him, it matters in friendship. In friendship, you're concerned for the other for the sake of the other. But the idea of being concerned for people outside friends for their own sake, that could get lost for Aristotle. And the other problem is it's like the other two systems. It's really rigorous. It's not so easy to have all these virtues to the max.
I have a third problem. And again, like it's you know, my colors are showing, but like Aristotle just decides like this is what human flourishing is, these virtues.
Right.
Like, oh, thanks, Aristotle, for deciding what my values should be. Because different people value different things.
Yes. And this is going to go back to Aristotle's, to the framework of his time. So he believed that there is objective in the sense that you originally used objective, right? That there is an objective good for each kind of being.
In a sense, almost a purpose.
A purpose. He called it a telos. Right.
Yeah.
And now we can jump on Aristotle for that, but let's put ourselves in a spot. He's got a very limited group of people around him. All he has is his ability to observe. And what he observes is that living things tend to go in a certain direction unless they're somehow damaged. But human beings are slightly different. We don't tend to go there because we have reason. And unlike what he thought other animals have. So we have to use our reasons. Okay, what would it be like to use your reason and learn how to flourish in this objective way, because everything has a telos. Mm-hmm. And once you set up that way, we don't have to buy everything, but it begins to make more sense. I remember there was a philosopher, Thomas Kuhn, who studied Aristotle, and he studied his physics and he studied his psychology and thought, how could this guy be that wrong? But then he turned and looked at what Aristotle was what he had at his disposal. And he said something that I've thought ever since, this is real wisdom about philosophers. He said, with a good philosopher, what you need to do is take that philosopher and not criticize them until you can look at the world through their eyes and it makes sense. And I think there's a way to do that with Aristotle,
okay,
seeing still his limitations. But once we do that, right, then the idea is
other problems.
there's a range of other issues that emerge. Yeah.
You know, Singer, I don't feel like he gets talked about much by common non-philosophical people, but my goodness, his way of thinking has, like, I feel like he's hugely influential. He's like one of those, it's like Iggy Pop, one of those rock performers that didn't sell many records, but they influenced a lot of other musicians.
Yeah.
And I even think about it in the effective altruism movement that you hear about, that, you know, that Sam Harris talks about on his podcast, and those people, you know, the guy who just did the cryptocurrency guy was a big effective altruism guy. But this idea of, listen, always try to maximize the good. I feel like Peter Singer really got in there. And my sense is that you look at all three of those things, and in addition to all the quirks that you point out that everyone knows that they have, your kind of ultimate quirk is they're so demanding that even if you agree with them, nobody can live up to them.
Yes. That, and then that raises the question, which the book tries to answer. Okay. How then do we frame our moral lives if we're not going to frame them in one of these three ways? And of course, there's Eastern ways too, but we'll leave them to the side. If we're not going to frame them like that, right, then how might we frame a moral life such that we can see ourselves in it? We look at our moral lives and it makes sense to us. And yet at the same time, offers us paths forward if we'd like to take them. But not paths forward that are predicated on the idea that we're lacking. Right? And some people are morally lacking. But most of us are trying to be decent people. And the question is, how are there ways for us to move forward? The terms we used earlier, right, to add a little more moral gracefulness to the way in which we move through the world.
And it sounds like what you're saying is if you understood how you actually walk, you would be able to walk more gracefully. The better you understand the mechanics of how you actually live, the more there's a possibility that you could live a little bit better.
That doesn't make it different from a lot of other skills now, does it? If I'm playing soccer and I learn what I'm doing when I'm playing, right, it's going to help me get better.
Yeah. If I come back to your, like start with just in your interpersonal relationships, like the people closest to you, what am I doing? What are most of us doing? It's funny because I spent a lot of my life as an inner city missionary back in my Jesus days. I was working in really hardcore ghettos, living in them, you know, like living, you know, cheek to jowl with people. And no matter what somebody was doing, like I was friends with serious drug dealers, people who shot people, people who did really terrible things. And almost all of us thought of ourselves as good people.
Yeah.
Like it was very rare that I would come across somebody. I mean, it would happen. And it was sometimes refreshing where somebody would look at me and go like, I'm just a bad man. Like, let's just start there. I'm a bad man. But most of us think of ourselves, or at least we want to think of ourselves as decent. Like, how do we walk as decent people? You know, Kant was asking, what should you do? And Aristotle was asking kind of like, how should you be? But like, how do most of us determine how we walk through the world?
One thing I often tell my classes is that people's ability knowingly to do evil is quite limited. People's capacity for self-deception is more or less infinite. And so we often don't see what we're doing. That's where reflecting on ourselves comes in. Asking ourselves, hey, what was I doing here? And of course, conversing with people we trust that could help us see what we're doing and what we're on about.
Which, by the way, not to jump ahead to the politics part, but like that's the absurdity of our politics right now, is that people look at people who are making different decisions or pushing different policies, and they go like, that person is evil and they know it.
Yeah.
And you go like, no. Most people aren't capable of devoting their life to doing something that's evil. You got to see people as, at the very least, you have to give them the benefit of saying they're probably deluded.
Yeah. And I think that's right. Very few people will knowingly do evil. And I think the category of people for whom morality and wanting to see themselves as decent, that category of people, I think, those are people we call sociopaths.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, as soon as I read your book, I wanted to ask you this question. But one of my sort of intellectual heroes is this guy named Jonathan Haidt.
Yeah. I've read little bits of him. Yeah. The psychologist.
And he wrote a great book called The Righteous Mind, which is why people disagree so virulently around religion and politics. One of his kind of like core TED Talky kind of ideas is that we all share the same moral instincts, that these are evolutionarily endowed in us, like a desire for purity, a desire for fairness, a desire for order. And he said the difference between people on different sides of the political aisle is which of these instincts sits higher on their list. What he's kind of saying is like, there's a reason why we are hardwired not to knowingly do evil. And he's sort of saying like, it's kind of evolutionarily hardwired into us that that's not good for us. It's not good for our tribe. It's not good for the world. And I just wondered, like, you really do believe that most, you know, almost like the Anne Frank thing, like that most people in their hearts are good.
I'll put it this way. I think most people in their hearts believe themselves to be good.
With that as your starting point, you go like, most people, they're not going to do evil knowingly, but we can delude ourselves.
Yeah.
So what do we do about that?
Well, part of the idea is to do philosophy, not in sort of technical grad school sense, but to do what I said earlier when I said you do philosophy, you, Bart, does philosophy, right? Is to reflect on ourselves. Gandhi once said, nobody's got all of the truth. And what each of us needs to understand is that none of us have all of it. And if none of us have all of it, that means we have to operate with a certain humility, recognize that we could be wrong about things that we thought we were right about. That also goes back to the discussion we had earlier about objectivity, right? Our best reasons be wrong, but they're fallible, capable of being wrong. And so that kind of reflective humility is one opening. It's not the only one, but it's one opening to be able to take into account what others might be saying to us, or to take an account of what we were on about and what we've done and reflect and ask about it. The Stoics, that I have some attraction to and some reservations about, the Stoics often would recommend, when you get up in the morning, ask yourself, okay, who do I want to be today? And then before you go to sleep at night, ask yourself, well, how well did I do that? Not necessarily to berate yourself, but to reflect on what you did, what you've done, and to ask how you might do it a little bit better the next time.
So if I'm hearing you right, you're saying like the beginning of moral decency within your household would be to sort of have a conversation going in your household and among your friends about what's right or what's best or what's most helpful. That in a sense, nobody has a corner on this. So the first thing you have to do is you have to be, the first step in being decent is trying to be decent, or is proactively thinking and talking about being decent.
Yeah. Maybe Bart, what even undergirds that is a way of seeing the other person as worthy of respect, as not something to be always completely dismissed. I think I mentioned in the book that, you know, when you get angry with your kids, there's a tendency not to look at them, right? Not to actually look at their face.
Right.
Because it's really hard to get really, really angry at your kid when you're looking at their face, because wow, you're seeing a person there.
You can't abstract them out into the bad thing they're doing.
That's part of what recognizing the humanity of the other is, right? Seeing them there in front of you.
Oh, you're kind of freaking me out, because my sister-in-law is an educator. And for the last 5 years, she's been pushing really hard on all of us that know her, this book and this idea known as positive discipline. Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard of it?
I've heard of it. But if you ask me what it's about, I couldn't tell you.
Well, I mean, it feels like, and all of a sudden I'm going like, oh my gosh, like this is the child rearing application of decency, because positive discipline is kind of based on this idea that in a family, you've got to create a conversation in your family that starts out with respect for everybody. You don't dictate to kids or punish kids like my way or the highway, because it doesn't teach them to think about other people as you know, to see other people as worthy of respect. So it's like, we need to talk about, like, is what you're doing, does that work for everybody in this family? And that the essence of it is that you're not strict or permissive, but rather that you offer your kids in every situation choices within a framework where all the choices are good. You can do this or you can do that, but where all the, but choices that are based on, like, I want you to have self-determination. I want you to feel like you belong, but I also want you to feel like you're responsible to the group. And I want you to feel like your decisions can not only impact the way that your life turns out, but they impact other people. And so it's kind of based on this idea that you have to have a conversation going and you have to set up a system in your house where there's a recognition that your behavior affects other people and that you have the power to make other people's lives better.
Let me put it this way, and you know, already know this, parenting's hard. Right. That's a great ideal. But sometimes you just got to tell the kid, look, man, shut up. Right. I worry that that ideal can be used to beat people up as parents with. When our third kid showed up, another parent said, OK, now things are going to change because you're moving from man to man coverage to zone.
Right? To zone. Yeah.
Because we got the three and it's hard. So I think that's right as an ideal. But if parents aren't always getting there, I think it's so easy to berate them.
I do a terrible job of, you know, I'm sure Jane Nelson, who wrote the book, would hate me for describing it the way she did. But I think, like, what the idea was is that you're trying to communicate to a kid this basic part of decency, which is you got to see other people as worthy of respect and consideration.
Yeah.
And there's a strange way in which sometimes when we punish a kid for hitting their sister, we're like, if you hit your sister again, you're going to your room or I'm going to spank you or something. And in a sense, you're trying to get the right behavior out of them, but their sister has nothing to do with it. Like, their sister's welfare and well-being, you're not teaching right. them that their sister is worthy. You're teaching them to obey the law. And there's a different emphasis there. And it sounds like decency, part of decency is recognizing that while the other people around you may not have an absolute demand on your time and energy and resources, they matter.
Right. But another part of decency is also recognizing that you're not going to be a moral exemplar. You hit your sister, right? You just go to your room. And then maybe later I'm like, okay, now I'm calmer, right? Let's sort this out a little bit and talk about what this involves. So I think that decency involves both the way you treat people around you and also the way you treat yourself.
Yeah, because you matter too.
Yeah.
And in some sense, does decency sort of accept the idea that, of course, I'm going to privilege myself in certain situations?
Like, oh,
that's
yeah.
just everyone's going to do that.
Yeah. And here would be the idea that this goes back to stuff we said about Susan Wolf and other values. Right? There are things I like to do that don't necessarily contribute much to the world. Many years ago, I was listening to a lot of jazz, and I decided to take up the saxophone, tenor saxophone. And I played tenor saxophone for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. And Bart, I can guarantee you nobody's life got better from that. My family's life in particular did not get better from my playing the saxophone in the other room. But it was something that was a value to me. My family was, shall we use the word, tolerant, right? They were kind of tolerant of. So it's, you can cut yourself a moral break, but also recognize that in putting yourself forward in doing certain things or taking up certain hobbies, it doesn't need to be a matter of making the world better. It means a matter of engaging yourself in something that's just worth doing.
The flip side of that is that sometimes it feels, I'm thinking about your family members suffering through your play. I'm going, like, sometimes it feels good to sacrifice for another person. Like, we're kind of hardwired for some empathy and some compassion too. And so sometimes, like, when we tolerate our loved one doing something that's hard for us, or when we give up something to make somebody else happy, in a strange sense, it's one kind of sacrifice, but in another sense, we go home that night, look in the mirror and go, like, I'm a good dad. I'm a good guy. And that pleasure may in some ways outweigh the sacrifice. And so in a sense, one of the questions I sometimes have is, you know, is there any such thing as an altruistic act? Because if I feel good about myself for doing it, and I know I'm going to feel good about myself for doing it, then did I really do it for the other person in the first place?
Right. But that's, and that's often presented as an either or, and I don't think it's an either or. Right?
No.
It's a both and.
And I would think that decency would somehow, I think it's hard to be a decent person if you don't enjoy the pleasure of other people. If you don't like seeing somebody else do well, if you don't, if it doesn't feel good to you to compliment somebody in the grocery store about the beautiful hat they're wearing and have them sort of go away feeling good, to be a decent person in some sense requires that you take some pleasure in other people's good fortune, right?
Right, and that's the moral gracefulness. That's part of the moral gracefulness of moving through the world. I mean, I remember when I was, you know, years back when I was doing political organizing, I was also like doing charity kind of work, like handing out food to folks and at a food pantry and things like that. And some of the more, you know, I'm sure you've run across these people, Bart, sort of like more radical than thou would confront you, right? Oh, I bet you feel really good that you're handing some groceries to someone. And my response is, yeah, I feel good about that.
Sure do. Like,
I am the man. I'm handing out groceries. And that's fine, right? There's this, I think, tendency when people start thinking morally, like saying to themselves, I'm thinking morally now, to consider, okay, what are the burdens I have to take on?
Yes. If it feels good, it must not be good.
Yeah.
If it's, you know, it's supposed to hurt.
I mean, there are moral burdens that are just moral burdens. There's no way around it. But I think a lot of what we, when we enter that space and start thinking about burdens, we're not thinking about aspects of it that can make this feel good. Make our if we're using the metaphor of the dancing, right? Make our step a little bit lighter as we're doing the moral thing.
So I got to ask you, when you think about that, like there are burdens there, that like it's funny because when I knew I was going to talk to a genuine philosopher today, I thought, okay, like the most philosophical show on television recently is The Good Place. You know, here's a guy writing about decency. I'm like, I'm going to ask him, like, what does he think of The Good Place? You know, because I get a lot of people that say, did you see that? Isn't it amazing? And then, so I start looking up The Good Place and there you are. Like you had a hand in that, like you and your wife, right?
There were two philosophical advisors. I was the main philosophical advisor. And then there was a person who was before me. It was also quite good. Pamela Hieronymy from UCLA. She was the philosophical advisor.
How do you get that gig?
Oh, accident. One of the writers was in a bookstore and saw my little book on death and picked it up and read it and said to Mike Schur, the showrunner, you need to read this book. Mike is a guy who reaches out to people. He's entirely unafraid of this. So I get email with the subject line, questions from a TV producer, tells me who he is and says, I'm sure you're busy, but would you have a few minutes to spare to talk about some of these issues? And so I looked him up and first thought was, I'm not that busy. Right. So, and so I actually said to my spouse, and she said, what are you going to do? I said, well, I said, this guy doesn't know it yet, but I'm going to be on the set.
I'm going to get there.
And I did. I'm in the last episode. I got a little cameo in the last episode, but I contacted him. I said, instead of a phone call, let's do what at that point it was Skyping. Let's Skype. And we just happened to get along. And we talked for 2 hours and I wound up, you know, talking regularly with him. And then before the third, fourth season, I went out there to talk to the writers. That was like teaching. It was like dying and going to heaven and having your philosophy class, right? The writers were just smart,
yes,
and funny.
Super
and
smart.
Great,
yeah.
Right. And then, about a week before they started filming the last episode, I got a call from one of the producers, say, hey, do you want to come out and be in a cameo? And I'm like, yeah, I do.
Very much.
So that's how it happened.
These days, I work as a therapist. Mm-hmm. And every now and then, and therapy's kind of, it's a good thing, but it's kind of a drag for me because in the old days when I was a college chaplain, you would have the same kind of conversations with people about their lives and their values and problems that they were having. You try to help them work things through. But then you would continue to know them. And every now and then you would see them in a relationship or in a conversation. And you would see the angle that they took. And you go like, oh, that's me. That's where I touched, I shaped that thought. Like they read that book because I recommended it, or they learned that skill. Remember when we were talking about that? And there was this just huge sense of like, I participated in the shaping of somebody else's thing. When you watch The Good Place, those last few seasons, do you know where you pushed and where your conversations with the writer showed up in the show?
Exactly. I know exactly where. I mean, there are just places where you can see it. I don't know if you've seen it all, and should I do a spoiler alert? I don't know.
No, okay. Believe me. If they haven't watched it by now, that they're not going to.
Okay, so the idea at the end was, you can't be immortal. Your life will become shapeless. You have to die in order for your life to be fully meaningful. And I told Mike at one point, I said, that's like what's in my book. My book argues that, right? Oh, I said, yeah. It's the same thing. And he looked at me and says, and you think that's an accident? But the other thing.
Well, by the way, I just stop you on that one?
Yeah.
And just go like, thank you. Like, that's probably the most important truth I have to share with anyone who comes out of an eternal life mindset and comes face to face with the reality of death, is the idea that it's not a bad thing, and that it's part of the bargain, and that the rest of the bargain doesn't work without it. Or as Robert Ingersoll once said, if the feast did not end, we wouldn't love each other at all.
Yeah. Yeah, there are great, you know, Borges has a great story about that, the immortal. Other philosophers, I mean, this is not original to me, right? Other philosophers have talked about this. I think one of the things that, if I made a contribution, it was that I was able to get it on a sitcom.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, thank you, because I can't tell you, I mean, you know how many people are sort of like, oh my gosh, if there is no heaven and there is no hell, then life is meaningless. And, you know, I'm sort of like, wait, no, it's the other way around. It's only meaningful if this is it. Otherwise, it evacuates this life of meaning if it's a dress rehearsal for some other show. And so that's one of the things about that show that I feel like was a genuine contribution to our culture. And so, like, yeah, feel good. That's amazing that you got that in there.
I didn't say put it in there. Right. And Mike read the book. He thought about it. He was convinced, and he decided that he was going to put it in.
Wow. That's a beautiful experience. Like, it's funny. I've written 16 books of philosophy, and maybe the most consequential thing I did was like slip something into a sitcom.
Yeah. I think probably. Wow. So it's certainly the most influential thing I'll ever do philosophically.
Yeah. And what's interesting too is that it sounds like Mike is a genuinely thoughtful person. Like, he's trying to be a good man.
Sure.
It's funny because, like, I've had a couple of tangential touches. I've got a kid in Hollywood, so I have some tangential touches with a few different shows and things like that. Like, the people that made Ted Lasso, like, there's some really good people attached to that show. It's really interesting to me. Like, was that your experience with the whole of that gang that was working on that show? Like, did you feel like it was a nice group of people?
Oh, yeah. Mike has a no-jerk policy. Doesn't matter how talented the writer is, he won't take them on, right, if they're not okay folks. And when I was there the first time, when I was with the writers, I asked him, I said, you seem to have a good feel here. Can you tell what the writer's room is like if you watch a show? And they said, absolutely. They said that if there is poisonous humor on the show, there is poison in the writer's room. If you look at the humor, you can tell what's going on in the writer's room. I've heard this is true with Ted Lasso. I can testify that it's certainly true, true in The Good Place.
You wrote a book about philosophical filmmakers. I mean,
one with Kenneth Lonergan.
Do you do much of that kind of consumption? Like, is that something you're interested in?
I mean, I love films. I know almost nothing about them. I watch a lot of them, and several of my close friends are film buffs. So I've sort of learned bits and pieces. That just came about because a guy that I know was approaching philosophers and said, "Hey, you want to do a book on the director?" And I said, "Well, you know, let me do this little book on Kenneth Lonergan. I met someone recently and said, I really liked your book on Lonergan." And I said, "Oh, you were the one who bought it. I wasn't sure who that was."
Hey, so if you can tell some, you know, if you go like writer, walking into that writer's room was heaven. Maybe this was when you were at Clemson, but like, I know that you taught philosophy in prisons.
Yes. Yes.
Was that?
That was a great experience as well.
Tell me about it.
For 2 years, it would have been four, except for COVID. For 2 years, for 10 weeks, I would go in and it was a maximum security prison. I would teach, basically would send three or four pages for them to read. It was all volunteer. They didn't get any credit. South Carolina's very about penalizing, not about developing in their prisons, right? And so it was just a matter of whoever wanted to show up. And I would get 15 people to show up. And so the first semester I did it with the what they called the good group. But it worked out well. And then one of the chaplain, who's the volunteer coordinator, said, "Look, we never have anybody go into the lifers dorm. Would you be," he says, "look like you could, would you be willing to go into the lifers dorm?" So, you know, I went to the lifers dorm and did the same thing with them for a couple of semesters. And then I moved to people coming off solitary, people who'd been in solitary for a long time and working with them. But what I found was that they were almost universally just really interested in the ideas. I wasn't doing the standard prison teaching thing of like, you know, here's how to be a better person than you are. But rather, here's a bunch of ideas. What do we think about them? Let's mull them over. Let's converse about them. And the great anti-death penalty lawyer, Brian Stevenson.
Yeah. I actually know him. He went to college where I grew up.
Okay. Well, you know his mantra then, right? Everybody's more than the worst thing they've ever done.
Yeah.
Right. And when I sat around a table with these people, that was part of the more, right? I mean, some of these people had done horrible things. But when we sat around the table and just talked about ideas, other aspects of who they were came out. They were curious. They were thoughtful. They ranged from people who had very little education to people who'd spent their time in solitary, reading enough philosophy that they could quote pages to me. But it was a conversation that was predicated on the idea that we're all just here together. We'll have something to say. We've got a text in front of us, and let's reflect on this.
It's so interesting because it's sort of I feel like to walk into a prison and talk to people about big ideas without trying to shape them in a particular direction, I feel like it almost requires that understanding that you articulated earlier. That is, that if you understand what you do, you'll be able to do it better. And so you're sort of like, I'm not going to tell you how to do it better. I'm just going to try to help you understand what you think or how we think, and we'll see what happens from there.
And they were coming from very different spaces. One of the things that the chaplain was keen on, which obvious to me when he said it, was like, don't go challenging in a deep way to people's faith. There would be different faiths and that helps them survive. And I'm like, I don't do that anyway. But I certainly, in this case, I wasn't going to do it. But there were top moments where people would say, well, you know, I'm a Christian or I'm Muslim, and this goes against some of the stuff that I believe. And I say, yeah, well, that's something you think about and sort out. You may decide that you want to rearrange how you're thinking about your Christianity or your relation to Islam. You may decide that that's more important. I said, I'm not here to tell you what you ought to think. This is just where we confront ideas and think about ourselves.
I mean, in some ways, it's funny because when I first left the Christian world, you know, I think people sort of expected that I would turn around with a flamethrower and want to lead everybody out of faith. You don't have to live in the world very long. And certainly, you know, growing up in the kind of Christianity that I did, you don't have to be there very long to realize that there's some people for whom that is the idea that is holding it all together. While the idea itself might not be rational, to believe it in their situation is a very rational choice.
I lived in Pittsburgh for 10 years. And for several years, I was the board president of the Thomas Merton Center, right? A Catholic liberation theology center, right? And my background's Jewish. And So they knew I was this atheist Jew, and they asked me, would you be the board president? I'm like, yeah, I'll be the board president. In fact, we had fun because the board vice president for a while was a woman named Lois Goldstein. So we had a board meeting together, and I said, well, Lois and I have got together, and we propose that the Merton Center become kosher. And it took a minute for them to realize that I wasn't really. But yeah, these are people I worked alongside of. These are people I admire. And they were operating out of their faith. And so who am I to tell them, yeah, that's not what you should believe. You should believe this other thing here.
So I got one last question for you, because you dropped it, and it's sort of matters, because I had written down in my notes, I thought, like, I'll ask him about the Stoics, because, you know, given your approach to death and given this idea of living within the realm of the possible that decency is sort of predicated on, I thought, he probably loves the Stoics. And you sort of went out of your way to say, like, there's some good things in the Stoics, but I got some problems with them. What are your problems with the Stoics?
Okay, so Bart, I actually have written a book on it.
All right, my research wasn't that good.
No, it was great. It's called The Fragile Life, and it's asking about suffering. And what I say is there are certain official doctrines, like the official doctrine of Stoicism, the official doctrine of Buddhism, the official doctrine of Taoism, more or less the official doctrine of Epicureanism, well, that's a more complicated story, which essentially tell you that you can get past suffering, that if you go...
You can escape it.
You can escape. You follow the Four Noble Truths or you're a good Stoic, right? You won't be suffering anymore. And my argument was, for most of us, it's not that we can't do it. I think for most of us, we wouldn't want to do it. It's not that we want to suffer, but we want to be the kind of people that are capable of suffering if something terrible happens. And so just to use a quick example, Bart, right? Imagine this. Do you remember when Flight 370 went down? It went into the ocean. Nobody knew where it was.
Yeah.
And they were gathered at the airport. They were waiting, but like, they were all in terrible pain. Now, let's suppose that someone came to them and said, look, I can give you something, right? I can give you a teaching, and then you won't feel the grief anymore if I give you this teaching, right? Most people wouldn't want it. It's not that they wanted to grieve. It's that the idea of the capacity for suffering and caring are so woven in for most of us that although we don't want to suffer, we want to be the kind of people who are capable of suffering under certain circumstances. And that's my reservation about things like Stoicism and Buddhism.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the famous Stoic saying, like, the problem is not things, but the way we think about things.
Oh, yeah. Epictetus said, when you put your kid to bed every night, right, imagine them dying before the morning, so that if it happens, then you won't be touched in the same way.
Yeah. And there's sort of a fundamental, you're like, Epictetus didn't have any kids. Because it's funny. I just finished listening to Anderson Cooper's podcast about grief, which is a really interesting piece of work and really beautiful in some ways, many ways. At one point, you know, he's talking to somebody, and he's saying, if you ask people, would you like to be relieved of your grief? They're like, I'd like it to be less acute. I'd like it to not overwhelm me at every moment of the day. But they would say, like, no, my grief is my connection to the person that I loved. And I wouldn't want to lose that connection. And see, that's all wrapped up together.
One of the ways I put it in the book is that it's not that we want to come to peace with our suffering, but oftentimes we want to at least have a kind of truce with it.
As a counselor, I know that my goal in grief therapy is not to take away somebody's grief, but rather to help them learn to bear it in a way with dignity, and that enables them to continue to enjoy other parts of life, and even to, in some weird way, enjoy the suffering that reminds them that there's somebody that they love. Okay. All right. So that's a really good critique. I mean, I know there's a whole book, but that's a really good critique of the Stoics. And I think of anybody that would say to you, hey, I can take away your suffering. Beware of people that offer to take away your suffering.
Yeah, right. But particularly if they actually could.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, they might as well come and say, hey, I can take away your humanity.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think for most of us, I think that's right. Yeah. I think maybe there's some people for whom it's better, but for most of us, I think that's right.
Hey, this has been such a privilege for me. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me.
Well, Bart, look, it's a thrill to talk to somebody who's reflective, who sits and thinks about things. I mean, what you're doing is philosophy, the way I consider philosophy to be done.
Oh, thank you. You know, the show really grew out of once I got, because I was a well-known Christian, when I left it, all these people started writing me letters, and they were all struggling with the same kinds of questions that, and I thought, you know, rather than writing back to every single one of them, especially because I'm such a painfully slow writer, my friend John, who you've met, John said, you know, you would be better off just making a podcast and doing episodes about the things that people ask about. And it's almost always people that are saying, what I'm trying to do is I want to live with the kind of devotion, the kind of purpose. I want to live with the things that I had as a Christian or as a Muslim or whatever they are. I want that kind of focus. And the idea of, well, how do I make the most of this life is something that I felt like there wasn't enough conversation with people like on the other side of faith. You know, so much of the atheist discourse is, aren't we smart for not believing in God? And that doesn't carry me very far when my kids are arguing.
Yeah, and I think of that as beneath what people should be doing anyway.
Well, what you're doing is really super helpful, and I'm probably going to circle back on you again next year because after listening to that Anderson Cooper, it was like a limited series or like 8 episodes in which he was sort of grappling with grief, and it would be a great episode for somebody who's struggling with grief to listen, a great show for them to listen to. What I realized is that you got a lot of people that are struggling with grief, but then I know a lot of people that aren't struggling with grieving another person. They're struggling with the specter of their own death. And I want to kind of put together a show where I bring a bunch of people from another angle and in a sense try to go like, let's talk about death in a way that, you know, will help you make your peace with your mortality and in fact, learn to celebrate your mortality. And so I just feel like, you know, I'm going to come back at you.
That it would be my pleasure.
Hey, so that was me and Todd May, and I hope you dug it. I dug him so much so that I really want to go back and read a bunch of Todd May books because I think that Todd may be the philosopher for me. You know, some people are like, I'm into Kierkegaard, I'm into Aristotle, I'm into, you know, all these, you know, Kant, I'm a Kantian and stuff like that. I think I may be a May guy. Maybe a May guy. Yeah, that sounds like a t-shirt. I got a Todd May quote for you that I'm going to give you. But before I do, since we talked about a decent life, I want to talk about a few decent people. And these are people that are so decent that one of the decent things that they do is they decently support this podcast. And you know who I mean, Steve Nesham and Raymond Cho and Tyler Wilson. And you too are decent, Corey Mounts and Kelly Alonso and Nicholas Fiala and Tim Miller. You too are decent. And this last person, I just got to say, I love your name so much. Amit Sinha, which back when I was a Christian, especially, that would have been such a great name to have. You know, people would have said, who are you? And I would say, I'm Sinha. I don't know. Maybe it would work. But Amit, what you are is a cool guy who supports our podcast, and we're really grateful to all of you because that's why we get to do this stuff, and it's a joy to do. So there. Okay. Oh, yeah. I promised you a Todd May quote, and here it is. Are you ready? It goes like this. It's really simple. He says, the best way to treat the watch then is to wear it. That's it. The best way to treat the watch then is to wear it. You know, it's at the end of a huge philosophical sort of discussion about like, what are things for and what is the proper use of things and what's the identity of a thing? The best way to treat the watch then is to wear it. The best way to treat your life then is to live it. The best thing to do is not to like meditate on it, keep it in a box, protect it. A bicycle wants to be ridden. A window wants to be opened and closed. A watch wants to be worn. Go for it. Go wear your watch, and I'll see you next time on Human Husbandry.
This podcast is made possible by supporters of the show on Patreon. Get an exclusive extra episode every month for less than the cost of a cup of coffee at patreon.com/humanizeme. You'll also get a video newsletter from Bart and some extra goodies. Our patrons make this show happen, so please, if you enjoy it, consider joining us. That's patreon.com/humanizeme. Bart's website, where you can contact him, is bartcampolo.org. And this episode is produced by Katie Johnson-Smith, me, John Wright, and Bart Campolo. You could be larger than life. You could.